Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bowne. Now, last week, I, along with a few guests, gazed into the culture crystal ball to see what we might be watching, reading and listening to in 2018, but there was a big gap, and that was art. So to remedy that, we've got a bumper list of standout exhibitions and events happening on the art calendar this year. And to big them up, I'm going to be joined in the studio by the curator and writer Francesca Gavin and founder and director of a new gallery space in London called Black Box Projects, Kathleen Fox-Davies. Together, we'll be sorting the wheat from the chaff, so you know the shows to make time for in 2018. That's all coming up on Culture with me, Robert Bowne, on Monocle 24. Kathleen and Francesca, welcome to the programme. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
It's been a good one. It's been an eventful one. If only we could have used the tape that started the show that was our warm-up thing instead of having to go straight into the arts. Many a new year was had, I think, across this
A desk. Very large Happy New Year.
Nice sounds. So in very short order, I'm going to ask you both, what was your standout thing? It can be one single painting, work of art, one thing from 2017, or something huge. Francesca, why don't you take
it
away?
For me, probably it was a more recent thing because it sticks in my mind, which is Ed Atkins' show at Martin Gropius Bau in Berlin.
Yeah.
Because it's bloody amazing. It's so interesting. It takes his work to another level. I'm a big fan of his work anyways. It's animation pieces, the whole costumes of the Deutsche Opera. It's incredible.
Yeah.
Ed Atkins is a good artist.
And a bit of I Heart Berlin in there as well.
I Heart Berlin in a big way.
Come on, it's all coming flooding back.
Exactly.
Kathleen, what was your standout for 2017?
For me, it was a couple of pieces from the Irving Penn exhibition in Paris at the Grand Palais last autumn, winter season. And they were the still life drawings and sketches by Penn. It's not something you normally see.
Yeah.
It's things that are not published or shown in the blockbuster exhibitions. But it really showed the artist's process and how he got to where he was going, and lots of colour theory and the really boring, gritty stuff. But I thought they were amazing.
We don't find it boring. It's nice. People will be writing this down in their pocketbooks.
Seek
That's
them
what
out.
People have,
They're
right?
Lovely.
People don't have iPhones, they have pocketbooks,
right? I have notebooks and pens.
Yeah, it's good.
And pencils.
Okay.
Very good Japanese pencils.
Yeah. Okay, people are scribbling. We can hear a legion of people scribbling down in their own Japanese pencils, Francesca. Okay, shall we hot foot it to 2018?
Yes.
It's a big one for Tessa Dean.
Yeah.
An interesting artist. Is she a video artist? Does she work in what we might call plastic art? What is she doing, and why is this seems to be the year of Tessa Dean in London? Francesca, give us a little bit of an entry point for our listeners into the work of this artist.
Well, Tessa Dean has very much kind of emerged around the year 2000 as one of those big, great new female artists. She was nominated for the Turner Prize. That was when a lot of people first saw her work. And she makes very big installation film works. She makes very large chalkboard drawings of sort of seascapes. She does photographic work. She's based in Berlin for a long time, now based in LA. But this May, she is having not one, not two, but three big giant museums devoted to her work.
We'll put a bit of echo on that in the post-production.
I mean, it's incredible. She's got the National Gallery, the National Portrait Gallery, and the Royal Academy. And it's the Royal Academy reopening after their closure around the back with their big refurb. So it's a huge, big, massive statement of her as a big name of British art. And I think it's going to be a really fascinating triptych of shows.
And there's a lot of reading the Royal Academy stuff, for one. There seems to be a lot of kind of her preoccupation with landscape. This is the more kind of, I guess, the gettable stuff of her oeuvre, or am I wrong in saying that, against the film
Actually,
stuff?
All three thematic shows are really interesting. So the RA is all about landscape and broadest conception of what landscape can be. The National Portrait Gallery one is all about her past examinations of portraiture of people like Klaus Oldenburg and Russ Cunningham and Cy Twombly, including photographs and video portraits she's made. And then she's curating a show, including her own work about still life at the National Gallery, which includes people like Ronnie Horne and Wolfgang Tillmans. So it's really interesting about, and also people like Zerberin, so who are in the National Gallery collection. So she's placing herself in this kind of, amongst her contemporaries, in a historical narrative, in this idea of what genre can be and how it can be reimagined in the 21st century. And I think landscape is a really interesting one because, at the Royal Academy, because that's often a genre, let's say, that seems as a little frumpier. In fact, actually, all three genres are not necessarily the hottest things in contemporary art.
This is something you might see a lot of at the National Gallery, less so at the Royal Academy, I suppose, as well.
I haven't been to a hot landscape show for a while, and it probably wouldn't be something, but I think it's really, I mean, she's doing a new film work based on Antigone under the concept of landscape, so I'm sure she's really stretching the conceptual breadth of what the genres can be. And I think it's going to be super interesting. I think it's a real statement of collaboration of the British museums and the British art scene to be working with someone who's not necessarily about sales, not necessarily about product, very much about experience. And I think it's going to be a really good chunk of shows.
It's about the collaboration, I think, that's so wonderful about it. I know that she was in talks with the National Portrait Gallery when the RA approached her, and instead of making her choose, they said, well, why don't we work together? It's a big deal for the RA, with it being the 250th anniversary year and the reopening of the Burlington Garden side. And she's actually created work specifically for the new space. So it will be a way of sort of making landscape cool again, as you were saying,
yeah.
and re-envisioning what the RA, who has always been a champion of the landscape genre, but bringing it into the now, into the contemporary, and hopefully making that space accessible to a much younger generation of art lovers and collectors. You sort of walk in there and, you know, any of us would bring the median age down significantly just by standing in the foyer. So it's nice to see that not only are they renovating for the future, but I think that they're trying to incorporate artists that are speaking towards the now and the future as well.
And that's very much because of the director, Tim Marlowe, who's an incredible, I mean, he's just brilliant.
He's got a good eye on the popular, for sure. And obviously he had a commercial gallery background, a broadcasting background, all these things he sort of brings to it. It's interesting, it's a statement of intent for the Royal Academy as well. Because there are a lot of artists they could have chosen.
Exactly.
So it's a feather in Tessa Dean's cap. Like, she needs one, but it's an interesting decision. There was obviously a lot of discussions had about who might be the artist to lead this new space.
And it's amazing that it's a female British artist. Let's be honest. There's only been five of them who've ever shown at the Venice Biennale representing this country, and this is quite a big statement of
support.
Yeah, I think it's really
fascinating. From the institutional side.
Completely.
Yeah.
Okay, so that is Tessa Dean. She's at the National Gallery, the National Portrait Gallery, and the Royal Academy of Arts. And that's all kicking off in March. Pierre Huyghe, this chap is an interesting artist. French artist. He's with Housen Wert, I think, right
with
now.
Housen Wert, yeah.
This is, again, an artist that's a little bit difficult to quantify. He's doing stuff at the Serpentine Gallery. This is from the 3rd of October until January 2019. So we're looking far into our crystal ball with this one. This is one of your choices, Francesca.
Mm.
We don't know anything about what's going to be in this show.
No.
But that's kind of, that's classic. That's classic Huyghe,
yeah,
as you would say.
Huyghe. This is an exhibition which I have absolutely no idea what it's going to be in, but I can tell you everyone is super excited just by its existence. He last had a show at Hauser & Wirth a couple of years ago. It was exceptional. You would touch a sculpture, which you could, that looked like a fountain, but it was actually hot. And there was like some of his best known video works. There were some aquarium pieces. He hasn't shown in a British institution since the Tate, which was a kind of a mini retrospective at that time. And I think his work's really developed a hell of a lot since then. That was before Documenta, where he really came through as like reinventing what the entire language of art could be. What an installation could be, how you can evolve ideas of nature and idea and poetry and existence. I mean, he is a really major artist. And even more, if you thought Documenta was enough, last year at Munster, the sculpture project, the crazy installation he made, basically with him, you have no idea what you're going to get. Even if it's just a reworking of his old work, it will be fascinating. He did a show at Centre Pompidou, which was a retrospective, and he reworked the walls of the show before and had sounds of bees flying around. And you really felt, I've seen some of the other exhibitions, but they're totally different in this context. So it'll be amazing.
So we're again in the land of the experiential, of not quite knowing what you're going to do, of someone kind of riffing on their own back catalogue as well, I suppose. I don't know why I'm dividing it between the curatorial and the market here. Well, slightly in a way, where do we place someone like Pierre Huyghe? He seems like he's one of those people that is a sort of European artist of a certain age, of a certain kind of genre, that's doing stuff that's kind of difficult to quantify, not curatorially and critically, I suppose, but in terms of the market. Where does someone like he sit?
Well, the pieces that really drive the institutions and the Biennale shows and the things that are harder to obtain on a domestic scale, that's what drives the entire market. And so while it might be more difficult to obtain as the everyday collector, the random Joe Schmo who just loves a piece and wants it in their home in London or in Berlin or in Paris, it's what's driving the smaller scale and the more attainable as well. So I think things like this are really exciting because it shows where we're going to go next and where we've been and what's possible in the creative sphere.
It's also intriguing to me when someone that is quite an avant-garde artist and there's an experiential thing and it has things that you can touch rarely for sculpture and interact with.
Yeah.
Where something that's actually quite avant-garde and quite intellectually based is actually all about fun or all about exploration and all about accessibility, or becomes almost
intangible.
In spite of itself very accessible. This is good stuff, right?
Well, I mean, a lot of his references are really interesting, the things that we can all get, but they're layered and layered, you feel, with research and intellectual philosophy, and there's deep, it's the work has layers of depth within it, and this idea of how we interrelate with technology and the future of like existence and ideas around psychedelica. I mean, there's so much you can read into them, even though he's actually quite obtuse about explaining what's going on in his work. There's not that many. You don't get a lot of, you know, he's not slutty with interviews, I'll put it that
way. Okay. Shwiggy, he might be called Shwiggy to his mates, but he's not classic band.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. He's not going for, I don't feel like he's going for a mass audience, but a wide audience are all drawn to his work nonetheless. He's not going to make it, he's not dumbing it down, but the work nonetheless is so interesting and so primordial, even if to the level of like the bugs in amber that like make up the earth, like how we eat, what weather does, like these kind of basic fundamentals are so part of what his work is now that I think audiences just can't help but want to watch it.
Yeah, they are. Exactly. I guess they are essential, I suppose, are they not? Pierre Huyghe, always interesting. He's going to be the Serpentine here in London. That kicks off way out in October. We might call it Freeze Week. I guess we shall. Next, we're going to be going... We're kind of on interesting, surreal territory. Lee Miller and Surrealism in Britain. This is going to be at the Hepworth in Wakefield. Kathleen, talk us through why you chose this one.
Well, I wanted to, first of all, leave London for a little bit.
Yeah.
It's the summertime. Let's go to Yorkshire. So,
well, you get too hot in London.
Exactly.
Okay.
Get some space, get some air. Lee Miller, Surrealism in Britain, is opening on the 22nd of June at the Hepworth Wakefield Gallery in Yorkshire. And this is I think it's a really interesting exhibition because Lee Miller has had some sort of revival and renaissance in the past few years. She is one that people like to say was forgotten and then rediscovered. But in actuality, she was a force to be reckoned with and a real driving force amongst her peers. And this show is what that's focusing on rather than seeing her as a forgotten entity. So the exhibition explores the rich strand of surrealism that was happening here in London and also in Britain, but London specifically, pre-war in the 1930s, but Lee Miller's involvement in it and how she interacted with those artists and was one of those artists and the collaborations that they came up with, as well as a photographer, her portraits of those artists, which a lot of them are in the National Portrait Gallery permanent collections. And they're pieces that you've seen, but you possibly didn't attribute to the surrealist artist in her own right.
So we get a bit of some of the making of this stuff, I suppose. We get a bit of the society around the surrealism. So who are the other artists? I know, obviously, that she worked with Henry Moore, who... She did.
Well, she was Man Ray's lover, muse, and collaborator before she ended up coming to London. So she had quite the credentials behind her.
Tick.
Yeah, done. Yeah. But specifically, this show is focusing on her friendships with Eileen Agar, Leonora Carrington, Max Ernst, and Renee Marguerite. And they will show works. Unfortunately, there were no images or previews to be seen. So all of this, we'll just have to go and discover.
Stuff, right?
We know
this
will be good stuff. But it's showing the collaborations that they did together, works of Lee Miller's that then directly inspired works that possibly are much better known by, say, Marguerite.
Surrealism, we think of it as, I guess, we think of Dali, we think of Marguerite, we think of the Belgians and the Spanish
and
the French.
It's so much bigger than that.
Yeah, and what is its British flavour, I wonder?
Well, it's that's a really good question. I think we might have to go to the show to
we'll
actually
go out
see.
There.
Yeah,
okay.
Because some of these artists you wouldn't necessarily attribute with being specifically British artists. So, I mean, obviously you've got Moore and those relationships that she had, but I think that you're going to see things that really did span and did touch into what was happening in Paris and what was happening in other parts of the world pre pre-World War II.
It was an interesting set of people. I think it rubbed off literally. Everyone had to sleep with everyone else or you wouldn't learn anything.
Exactly.
That was the rule. Right?
Exactly. Is it only then?
It wasn't only then. It wasn't only then. Let's not get talking about New Year again.
No.
Come on. Okay, we're looking forward then to heading up country a little while to see Lee Miller and Surrealism in Britain. That is at the Hepworth Wakefield from the 22nd of June until the 7th of October this year, 2018. We were kind of sort of still, I'm still kind of getting used to saying that. Next year, I almost said next year, 2018. Let's talk about some new openings, some other places as well. So the Hayward Gallery has been having a little bit of a lie down and a rest, mm-hmm. hasn't it? Ralph Rogoff, its director, he's off to, is he the next?
He's doing Venice.
He's doing Venice, so mm-hmm. he's going to be a busy boy. So the reopening show, which seems like it's got landmark written all over it, is Andreas Gursky. Who would like to talk about him first?
I will go ahead and start. This is a really exciting show. First of all, the Hayward Gallery has been quiet and dormant and closed for 2 years, busily working on a refurbishment that will revitalize that amazing brutalist landmark and bring back some of the wonderful features that were conceptualized at the opening but never really worked, so they had to be boarded over.
They're doing something with the roof, they're
remaking the pyramids. I think it's 60 pyramids that are skylights that were actually Henry Moore's. He conceptualized it. He was a member of the Arts Fund at the time and insisted that God's light be shown on the artwork inside. So it really will change this space because all of a sudden the light will be different in each room that you go to. It gives almost, I think, 2 meters extra space in the upper galleries as far as height. So that's really exciting to see. And they've chosen Andreas Gursky to open. It's also their 50th anniversary year. Seems to be landmark years for most of the institutions. And this show is actually really exciting. They will have over 60 pieces.
So is this kind of a survey show?
This is the first UK retrospective for the artist. There are over 60 pieces, and all but 8 have been seen before. But the works are all coming from Gursky's private collection. He notoriously holds back 1 AP of every piece he's ever made, which there are only 240, which is incredible over a 40-year span that that's all he's made. So that comes out to about 5 pieces a year, just to give you an idea of what, and you don't really see that with a photographer.
So we're seeing these famous gargantuan photographs.
But he lets it be known that he has the right to change the variables of the dimensions. And because he's constantly experimenting, even with works that are completed and published, and other artists would have walked away and moved on. So we're seeing all but one of the pieces will be in sizes different than what we've previously seen and what are sitting in permanent collections of museums and private collections. There are 8 new works that have never been seen before that will be opening with this show and unveiled to the world, which is incredible, seeing that he, on average, creates about 5 a year, that we're getting 8 all in one go.
This is an interesting one. And you were talking, Kathleen, about the idea of scale, which is so important to his work as well.
Yes.
And the idea that actually just changing the size of one of his photographs changes its meaning, changes what we understand of it and all the rest of it. That's a kind of very interesting
thing. I think some of them are actually going to be in much smaller scale than what we'd anticipate.
A quarry on a postage stamp.
A handful are going to be much smaller than what we've ever anticipated from this artist. And I know that because of the space that what the Hayward allows, there could be pieces that are just mind-blowingly massive, which is what he's known for, is really pushing the boundaries of scale and what a photograph can be and how big it can be. And I think it'll be impressive, particularly in that space that does ramble. And it is about walking into it and getting trapped and discovering the rooms. There's no linear path through that gallery.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting back into that funny old building as well.
Yes.
Right?
It's such a beautiful.
I know.
I used to be quite scared of it growing up.
Me too.
I was a bit like, I'm going to get lost in some weird, brutalist nightmare.
Yeah.
But then it becomes home.
Like the Barbican, you come to love it.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Which I do.
Yeah, but it is. I had exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
But I've been driving past it recently on the way home and seeing those pyramids lit up. Mm-hmm. It's a rather lovely thing, actually. They were pink the other night, blue the other night. They're kind of making a little play of the fact that we're here, we're coming back.
Yeah. Well, they've actually enhanced those. They've made them bigger so that they are something that's seen from the outside of the building as one of the, the iconic views of the Hayward. So I think it's really exciting because that's a gallery that's really embraced the internal versus the external with their terraces and putting art on the outside.
Yeah.
And they're doing the same thing with how they're relooking at what their architectural vision should be.
So Andreas Gursky, welcome back to the Hayward. Andreas Gursky opens on the 25th of Jan, and that's until the 22nd of April. Francesca, over in Paris, there's a new gallery opening called the Lafayette Anticipation Institute. I've said it in French.
Pourquoi pas?
Why not? It's a Rem Koolhaas building. Are we excited about this?
Yeah, this
one
has been really interesting. They've been working on this for a few years, and it's been basically focusing on smaller projects with emerging artists. I actually went last year and went to the building site of this amazing
hard
space.
Hat tour.
I had a hard hat tour of Rem Koolhaas's architecture. So they basically, it's in the middle of the Marais, walking steps from the Pompidou, which in itself is an incredible location, and quite a big statement for a foundation to be doing in the middle of Paris. They're very particular about their, you know, 18th, 19th century architecture. And they basically gutted a building and then placed a kind of atrium in the middle, which can be moved in different intersectional ways. There's a lot of light in there. There's a lot of floors. I think their main focus leading up to this has been on performance and much younger emerging artists, but they're launching with Lutz Bacher in March 10th. I think this is going to be a really interesting, I mean, Paris has been really revamping its emerging art scene, full stop. Paris International is one of the most interesting fairs out there at the moment, to coincide with FIAC. I think this is quite exciting, and I think they're going to do interesting things. And if nothing else, there'll be a restaurant and a shop there.
Yeah.
And it's a new place in the Marais that kind of extends it into it, and it's very much for a younger public audience.
Yeah, it's good. Paris dusts off its museum-y old vibes once again.
Not so frumpy. Right?
No, not so frumpy.
Yeah.
A bit more leg.
Yeah. A mini skirt.
Yeah.
A cultural mini skirt.
Okay. Okay. They definitely want that on their poster, yeah. Francesca. Offer it to them.
Yeah, of course.
Okay. So I think we've got 5 minutes to do a bit more of a roundup of other things we like. Mm-hmm. I know, Francesca, you wanted to talk about Manifesta manifesting itself in Palermo this year.
Yeah,
what might we be looking forward to?
Another Rem Koolhaas segue. Because obviously he's the curator of Manifesta 12. I obviously have a deep relationship to Manifesto 11, because I co-curated it.
Congratulations.
Thank you. This year, it's really interesting. Palermo, wow, that's going to be a really tough place to relate with, but everyone's going to want to go. Mm. Also, having an architect curate an art biennial is going to be really interesting, because I think that might be quite a pull, and I think we'll definitely see more of an architectural vein towards the work coming out of it. I have no idea what this is going to be like either.
Do you know what the title is?
I have no idea what the title
it's
is
called,
either.
The theme is The Planetary Garden Cultivating Coexistence.
Nice.
Wow.
Yeah? What do we think about that?
Well, I mean,
would you buy seeds from this man?
Well, there's going to be a lot of ruins in that. I mean, it's a crumbly city. There's like a sense of that kind of Lampedusa leopard like decay.
Totally, yeah.
And I think that's what makes it an interesting place. I mean, Manifesto traditionally over the past 20 so years has gone every 2 years to a different city, initially to lesser used places. I mean, after this, they're going to Marseille, which I think would be another great city to end up with. So I think Palermo's, Not without its crumble.
Yeah.
A little bit more of a kind of edgy crumble.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? A lot of bibas. But I think Palermo's a really interesting choice as a kind of different vision of Italian. You would expect things to be in Milan, maybe even Rome, but Palermo's definitely off the obvious art world tour, and I think that means everyone's going to want to be going.
Interesting vibes in Palermo,
and
architectural vibes from Koolhaas. Mm. Yeah, interesting stuff. In a bit more sort of bricks and mortar, straight backed way, we're going to celebrate 25 years of David Zwirner in New York.
Yes.
He's an interesting character, a pro. Does it feel like 25 years since David Zwirner's been around? He seems very, very, it seems to me to be sort of front and centre.
Front and center, but also really accelerating his program in sort of the past decade. So impossible to ignore. And this January, he is also opening his first space in Hong Kong. Mm. So inter-world domination. Here we go. But the 25 years show at David Zwirner is celebrating just that. It's celebrating the artists that have helped shape that gallery and the artist-led program over the past 25 years. So he opened in 1993, I believe, in Soho, and has sort of migrated through the different art hubs of New York as they've sprung up. He now has 4 or 5 spaces in Chelsea.
He's got a block, hasn't he?
Yeah, which is it's insane.
Yeah.
One of them being 5 full floors. And the show is going to be in all of the Chelsea spaces. They will be showing historical works that have never been seen before, as well as newly commissioned pieces by artists to celebrate this landmark year. So I think it shall that'll be quite a cool exhibition.
Yeah,
they always put on a good show, having a bit more of a retrospective style of all the different artists, because his vision and scope is so vast that it should be really interesting. And there's also a catalog that's being published that will focus on the almost 400 exhibitions the gallery's hosted since its opening. So get thee to New York, and if you can't, buy the catalog.
He's one of those interesting people, despite being such a big cheese, a grosser Kaiser, potentially.
Yeah.
He's very good with his artists. I've interviewed him once or twice, but certainly having seen him interacting with some of his artists, they really love him, and I think that's nice to see.
Well, it's really serious about it, and if you've got people like Kerry James Marshall and Google
That was a show at his. He got on so well with. They were clearly really good mates,
because they also have a real. They're really interested in the history of painting and what that could be. And I think Serena's pretty damn good when it comes to painting, but also just a variety of he has an incredible roster.
He really does. And I think what has drawn me to the gallery is that David Zwirner and the staff and the gallery spaces that they create together, they're huge, they're imposing, but they're incredibly accessible. And you don't normally find that. I think New York particularly, I worked for many years in New York and Chelsea, and the galleries were known for having a receptionist that all you saw was the top of their head, maybe some nice fringe or headband. That was the era that I worked there. Headbands were really in. But there was no one there who actually engaged with you, that would speak to you, that would talk to you about the artist. And if you did want to speak to someone, you had to wait upwards of 30 minutes for someone to come down from the upper offices to speak to you. And you never, ever got that with David Zwirner, which I think is a real testament to how he's running a truly community interactive gallery, which you don't see at this level normally.
Yeah, even if you're not buying, you can learn.
You can learn. You can go in, you can have a discussion, and you never know. That person that had that great discussion 5 years from now might be their next big collector. And there's just a real sense of engagement with that gallery. I think specifically, the London Gallery now has children days on Saturdays. Mm. You don't see that at these sort of blue chip galleries. It's really incredible how they've evolved and are continuing to engage and to challenge what a gallery can be.
Life beyond the black bangs.
Yes. Right? From the headband.
Yeah.
Beyond the headband.
Beyond the headbands,
yeah.
I like it. It's pretty good, isn't
way
it?
Way back then.
The neon headband. That's something else. That's New Year's Eve again.
Not my New Year's Eve.
Okay. I'm not saying that that's what you wear. And finally, in personal news, Kathleen, you're opening a gallery. That's good news.
Yes, I am launching a gallery.
The
Black Box Projects. We are based in Mortimer House in Fitzrovia, and we are a gallery concept that will be hosting pop-up exhibitions for the next 2 years throughout London until we move into our permanent home. It's currently under construction. So, but we are solely looking at contemporary photography and artists that are engaging in the medium of photography in a new way, pushing the boundaries. So we will have a what I hope will be a very exciting launch exhibition at the end of the winter, early spring season, and we will be showing at Photo London in May with one of our artists, Steve McLeod, a brand new series of work that will be unveiled for the first time there, a solo show. So
well,
that
hats off
be...
without wanting to tempt fate. Congratulations
Excellent.
In
Thank
advance.
You.
The Culture Show will certainly buy you a pint. Francesca, you had such a wonderful 2017 of curation, books out, all the rest of
it. Yeah, my main thing at the moment is just literally the rest of my... I just did a collaborative book with Pentagram.
Yeah.
And that's come out called Watch the Space, which is dissecting our relationship to the screen. It's limited edition. There's a couple of hundred... 150 of the 500
behold,
copies left.
Though. It's a good... Stunning. It's, the medium is also the message as well.
Yeah, and it's also... I basically look at the screen within the idea of how it's affecting our relationships with our psychology, our emotions, politics, defining what the screen can be. Because we're all looking in our phones, aren't we? And you're probably listening to this on your computer.
Yeah.
So therefore, I really wanted to get to grips with that. So that was been my most recent thing of focus.
A thing of focus. We've gone from the pocketbook to the iPhone and back again.
Yes,
basically.
Exactly.
Thank you both so much. It's
Thank
always
you.
So lovely to have you in the studio. That is the end of the Culture Show for today. The show was, of course, produced by Holly Fisher. Why not join us a bit later this month when we will be reporting from the opening of the newly refurbished Hayward Gallery. We'll be putting those pink pyramids in perspective. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bounds, and thank you very much for tuning in.